From Pennsylvania to Missouri, North Dakota to Maine, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, how did the U.S. fare in the recent G6 summit? And is a recession really on the horizon? We get answers from Steve Moore of FreedomWorks. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth Foundation has been working on legislative scorecards in Florida, Virginia, Tennessee, and New Mexico. He has the real story. Democrats in Congress are proposing a number of new laws that would dramatically restrict worker rights and force many into labor unions against their will. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Trey Kovacs of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And no state has ever gone insolvent or entered bankruptcy, but it could happen soon, and the effect would be significant. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It has been a busy week on the economic front as the G6 summit concluded, the trade war with China heated up, and the left is trying to talk us into a recession. Here to sort through all of that is Steve Moore. Steve is an economist with FreedomWorks and author of the book Trumponomics. He also served as an economic advisor to the Trump campaign. Steve, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Steve, before we start talking about price controls, which we want to do here in a minute or so, we had the recent G6 summit. President Trump was there. There was a lot of controversy surrounding the summit. I'd be interested in your take as to how well you think the president and the United States fared at that event.
Well, look, first of all, I think the big story of the G7 summit was what a shameful performance it was by the Europeans. I mean, here we are in this epic battle with the Chinese to try to have them start to play by the rules and follow international law and stop the cheating and stealing and in terms of intellectual property that is really hurting the whole world. And yet the Europeans acted as if they were siding with the Chinese rather than when Trump and the Americans in this. And, you know, you really know who your friends are. These are supposed to be some of our greatest allies, and they were browbeating Trump. And instead of having a unified front against China, which we need to do because China has become such a menace to the world economy and the security. So I was extremely disappointed, I think, as the White House was, that the Europeans can't seem to understand who their friends are and who their enemies are. And by the way, China's predatory trade practices aren't just negatively affecting the United States. They're negatively affecting the Europeans as well.
Can you explain for our listeners a little more, Steve? We have this trade war with China, and of course, it's caused volatility in the equity markets, and there is some pain associated with the various tariffs that are put on. What is at stake here? Why is the president so resolute in this battle?
Well, because we're in an abusive trade relationship with China. I mean, they steal $300 billion a year of our intellectual property, which is our computer software, our patents, our vaccines, our copyrights, and more of what we produce as Americans is intellectual property, technology. That's all stolen. It's not, they don't buy it, they steal it from us. And so we can't go forward with that kind of relationship with the Chinese. And then, of course, they're becoming more of a national security threat every day. With respect, it looks like their troops might move into Hong Kong, and they're building up their military in a very big and aggressive way. So this is the, as I just said, this is the epic battle of our time between the United States and China. And, you know, China is the one wearing the black hats, and we're the ones who are fighting the good fight. And I'm proud of the fact that Donald Trump is finally standing up to China and saying, we're not going to take this abusive treatment anymore.
It's interesting. Democrats in Congress have often railed against China and against the various infractions that you've just outlined. Yet they're critical of Donald Trump for this trade war. Is this not a time when there ought to be more bipartisanship?
Yeah, you would think so. And one of the most important things we need to do right now is pass the Mexico-Canada trade agreement. And yet the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi are holding that up, and I don't understand why. I mean, we need to get that. I know the reason why. They don't want to hand Trump a political victory, even though that trade deal is very much in the United States' interest of all workers and companies. And so the bitter partisanship and the toxic nature of Washington is really preventing good legislation from getting passed.
Let's pivot now. We want to talk a bit about price controls. And of course, our economy is supposedly a free market economy. And the price controls we're talking about, particularly, are on pharmaceuticals. So what move is afoot in Congress and among regulators here?
Well, this is a big issue for those who want to see the win the race for the cure, whether it's cancer or heart disease or multiple sclerosis or whether it's Alzheimer's. You know, we're so close to coming up with some of these miracle cures that could really benefit millions and millions and millions of people, not in just in the United States, but around the world. And yet the only way that research and development and innovation will happen is if the drug companies can make money making it. I mean, that's the way the free market system works. You come up with something that is going to be a new invention or innovation in pharmaceuticals. And yet it's interesting to me, the Democrats, I listened to Elizabeth Warren. She acts as if the drug companies are these villains when, in fact, they're the ones who've come up with all these wonder cures that relieve pain and also suffering and also save lives. And so we don't want to look, we all want low drug prices. I do, you do, everyone does. But you don't want to take the profits out of making drugs, or else you're not going to have the next generation of cures. And that's why I think this idea of price controls on the drug companies, it'll save money in the short term, but it'll hurt America's health in the long term.
Steve, you, of course, are an economist with FreedomWorks. You've been a senior advisor to the Trump campaign, the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Let's talk for just a minute or so about the state of the economy. The Democrats and the left and the media have been beating the drums that a recession is apparent.
Yeah.
As an economist, do you see that on the horizon?
No. I'd never say never, but we have a very strong economy. Look, we got the 50-year low in unemployment rates, 50-year low in interest rates, 50-year low in inflation. Wage gains have been very strong for workers. You see that in the consumer spending numbers that are, people are shopping like crazy now because they have more money in their wallets. The trade war certainly has hurt the economy. It's hurting China more than it's hurting us, but knocked probably half a percentage point off of growth. We've gone from 3% growth down to about 2%. But look, I don't see it. We have the strongest economy in the world. We have 7.5 million surplus jobs today. States like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan are definitely on the big comeback right now. So I don't know. I think a lot of that recession talk is just wishful thinking by the people who hate Trump. And I wrote a column on this week saying these are people who are rooting for a recession. They want it to happen because Democrats want to take back political power. So they're hoping that the economy, people, millions of Americans will lose their jobs. And I think that's rather cynical and unpatriotic to root against the American worker and the American businesses so they can regain political authority and power.
Oh, that is indeed a sad commentary. We have been talking with Steve Moore. He's an economist with FreedomWorks, also author of the book Trumponomics. And Steve, tell us where folks can go to learn more about FreedomWorks, possibly also get a copy of your book.
Well, please do. I mean, freedomworks.org is the website, and Trumponomics is available on Amazon. Thanks so much for what you do, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Take care. Well, this week, we welcome back an old friend who is with us weekly for many, many years. He actually still is doing some work for the Club for Growth, just in a bit of a different capacity. So a big welcome back to Andy Roth. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Loman. Long time no talk.
It has been a while, and we're pleased that you're able to join us this week. Scott is off. And you have been working on a project for the Club for Growth. So tell us a little bit about your scorecard effort.
To be more precise, the Club for Growth has launched a new organization called the Club for Growth Foundation. As the executive director of the Club for Growth Foundation, I'm in charge of helping educate the public about the virtues of free markets and limited government. And one of the things that we wanted to do is look at the state level of government, because what we're recognizing at the federal level is that a lot of the people that come into Congress had experience in state legislatures, in state government, as a state senator, as a state House member, and they're already pre-wired when they're in Congress, when they enter Congress, to behave a certain way. And it became clear to us that there is very little accountability at the state level. There are existing scorecards out there for state legislatures, but it's kind of a hodgepodge of scorecards. Some states don't have any, or if they do, they're not widely known. Some states do have well-known scorecards, but our view is that the more scorecards, the better. And so what we're trying to do is bring accountability at the state level. So what the Club for Growth Foundation decided to do was to launch a state scorecard effort.
Okay, so you're starting out with the first four states, and I think you made a great point, Andy, that folks who get elected to seats in Congress usually do come from the ranks of state legislatures, so usually past is prologue, and we can take a look at what they've done, and that can somewhat predict where they'll go. So let's talk specifically about the four states that you have done an initial scorecard in. You live in Virginia. Let's start there.
The Republicans hold a very slim majority in both the Senate and the House. So Republicans have a tough time passing their agenda, which is what it's like in the U.S. Congress. And so what we see is that they're kind of passing some good stuff, but they're always spending a ton of money. As your listeners know, Amazon went on a hunt to find their second headquarters. And they tried to extract as much money as they could from states who are willing to throw out tax dollars to bring Amazon to their state. Well, Virginia won that. And so they obviously had to vote on that bill in the Virginia legislature, and it passed with overwhelming support. But it's nothing more than crony capitalism. It's favoring Amazon over other companies. It's using tax dollars very unwisely. And that's just one of the votes. They also raised taxes in order to spend money on transportation. And it wasn't that they decided to raise taxes after thoughtful, long debate about other alternatives. They just quickly called a one-day session, raised taxes, gaveled the session closed, and left town. So that's kind of the behavior that Virginia was operating under this year. The highest Republican in the Senate only got 80%. Thankfully, in the Virginia House of Delegates, the top score was 100%. And that's by Delegate Nick Freitas, who is actually thinking about running for Congress, and he would be a great addition if he does. But overall, the average Republican score in both was 63% in the Virginia House and just 55% in the Virginia Senate. The Democrat scores are even worse. Obviously, they're down in the teens, and it just doesn't look good for Virginia. If Republicans want to reclaim large majorities in both chambers, I think they need to start acting like conservatives and not like the liberals that they're behaving like right now.
Well, let's go south to Florida, where the news is much cheerier. So tell us how things are going there. Florida, of course, with a new Republican governor, things looking better there?
Indeed, the Sunshine State is much sunnier down there, at least the results are. Florida has always had a reputation of being very conservative. They don't hold large majorities, but they just have a very conservative bent. And this year was a fantastic session. They passed a lot of health care freedom bills. They required more accountability from local governments. They expanded school choice. They did all sorts of wonderful things. And the average Republican score in the House was 96%, while the average score in the Florida Senate was 83%.
You also did a scorecard in Tennessee. And did Republicans there act like Republicans?
The frustrating thing about really, really red states is that Democrats quickly realize that they can't get elected as Democrats. So they just put an R next to their name and run as a Republican, even though their ideology hasn't changed. For instance, in Tennessee, the Republicans have 28 members in the Tennessee Senate and only five Democrats. So it's a supermajority. But the average Republican score is only 64%. The Tennessee House isn't much different. There are more Democrats there, but it's still a huge majority, 73 Republicans to just 26 Democrats. But again, the Republican average is just 67. They did pass some good stuff, and they passed some bad stuff.
And then we have New Mexico. That's your fourth state that you've done. Much more to the left there, obviously, than Tennessee.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not much to say here. You know, when people think of really liberal states, they think of New York, Vermont, California, Oregon, all those coastal states. But New Mexico is very, very liberal, and our analysis of their legislature shows that. The highest Republican in the Senate got just 72%, while the highest Republican got 85%, which isn't so bad. But the average score was 69% in the House and just 53% for Republicans in the Senate. So it was pretty bad. They have a Democrat governor, and the governor passed her agenda, and that included a huge budget. It included multiple tax increases when they had a budget surplus. That's the most frustrating thing.
We will continue to keep an eye on these scorecards as you develop more of them. And we've welcomed back Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, where can folks go if they'd like to really take a deep dive into the results of these scorecards?
If you want to go see the scorecards, you'll need to go to clubforgrowthfoundation.org, and you'll find all the scorecards that we mentioned today.
Andy Roth, thank you for being back with us.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
In its Janus v. AFSCME ruling last year, the Supreme Court upheld worker rights not to be forced into a labor union. But now congressional Democrats are working to put new restrictions on those rights. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the issue with Trey Kovacs from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Well, the Democrats control the House. They control one half of Congress, and a whole bunch of them are running for president next year. So you knew it was really only a matter of time until the labor unions got a big political grab bag in front of Congress in the form of some legislation that's known as the Protecting the Right to Organize Act of 2019. Sounds nice, doesn't it? It's anything but, and it has significant implications for privacy and for workers' right to choose not to be part of a union. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Trey Kovacs. He is a labor policy analyst over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute right here in Washington, D.C., and he joins us on the phone to talk about this bill, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act of 2019. Trey, you've been on the show several times before. Thanks for coming back.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Always glad to have you here, Trey. As I said, this legislation introduced in the House, it is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. That sounds good, sounds great. I guess everything in Congress always sounds good if you just read the titles of the bills. Really, what this is, though, is it's an attempt to bolster union membership, and it's an attempt really to, if I understand it correctly, Trey, to sort of put a thumb on the scale when workplaces are making the decision about whether to unionize or not.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. Basically, all this bill tries to do is force workers who don't want union representation to be represented by a union and force them to pay dues to a union they don't want.
So the legislation here has a number of components, Trey. We don't really have time to go through each and every one of them, but one of the big ones is something that you guys are highlighting as the ambush election rule. And this is something that, if I remember correctly, we talked about this. I think I may have talked about this with you back during the Obama administration. It was the NLRB was trying to implement this ambush election rule. Tell our listeners a little bit about what this is and why it's back again.
Yeah, unfortunately, the NLRB successfully promulgated the ambush election rule, and this bill would codify it. And so the real problem with this provision of the bill is that workers need ample time to contemplate whether or not they want a union. There needs to be robust debate during a union election so they get to hear both sides of the story. And what the ambush election rule does is make sure that workers only hear from the union and that they can't hear from their employer about what the potential downsides of unionization is. And the NLRB data shows that union elections are held pretty quickly. The median election takes about 38 days. So it's not that union elections are being protracted out and taking 100 days or anything like that. And a really pernicious provision of the ambush election rule is that employers would be forced to give unions who are trying to organize a group of workers all their private information, so home address, cell phone, email address, work schedule, so they know when they can reach them at home or at work, and with no ability for the worker to opt out.
Explain the rationale there, if you can, Trey, because, I mean, this seems like a pretty obvious privacy issue to me. Is this just about being able to harass people while they're at home, or is there some other reason why the unions would want that?
It really is all about harassment. And even the Obama National Labor Relations Board acknowledged that there could be problems with releasing employees' private information. They said it could be sold to telemarketing services or used to harass, coerce, or rob employees. And so that's from the Obama NLRB. So if they even acknowledge these concerns, there's probably something to it.
Yeah. No doubt about that. You are listening to American Radio Journal. I'm Eric Bain. We're talking with Trey Kovacs. He's a labor policy analyst over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and we are talking to him about House Resolution 2472. That's the Protecting the Right to Organize Act of 2019. It is, as CEI puts it, a grab bag of union-favored items, really just a collection of things that, labor unions have been trying to get into law for quite some time, and they've just stuffed them all, helpfully, right inside this one bill. Trey, something else in here that I think we should bring a little bit of attention to is a policy known as card check. That's something that unions have been pushing at the state level for years. It's certainly on their wish list in lots of red states at the moment as well. And it's included in this bill. What is card check? How does that work? And why are the unions interested in that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the card check provision really goes hand in hand with provisions of the ambush election rule. So since they have all of the workers' private information, what they want to do, instead of having a secret ballot election, they go to individual employees and try to intimidate or coerce or harass them into signing a card that says that they support a union. But what unions do a lot of times is tell them, okay, we'll sign this card, but it's really for more information about the union, not that you're saying that you want to join and have this union represent them. And that's really the issue with card check, is that union organizers use a variety of methods to try to trick or coerce workers into signing these cards. And really, there's no reason not to have a secret ballot election. If workers really support a union, they'll have no problem winning an election at the polls.
Yeah. So you're eroding the secret ballot, and you've got those privacy concerns we talked about earlier, really lots of worrying stuff in here. Look, the bottom line is that Republicans control the Senate. President Donald Trump is in the White House. It doesn't seem likely that this sort of package is going to become law anytime soon. I imagine, is this just an attempt to sort of to give an indication of where Democrats would want to go if they take control of Congress and the White House in 2020 or at some point after that?
Absolutely. That's Chuck Schumer, before the 2018 elections, already said that labor policy was going to be right at front and center if they won the Senate and the presidency. So this is really laying the groundwork, and you've seen in all the presidential campaigns, they've all put out their labor plans that are all very similar to the PRO Act here. So this is something people need to educate themselves on and realize that it takes away employee free choice and harms worker privacy.
We are unfortunately out of time for today. That is Trey Kovacs from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Trey, thanks for taking some time and being with us today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much.
And again, Trey Kovacs, a labor policy analyst over at CEI at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can check out more about the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, the PRO Act of 2019, at CEI.org, where Trey has written all about it. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out my work at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
No state has ever gone bankrupt, but what would happen if one does? We get the answer from Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The economic crisis and bankruptcy plaguing Puerto Rico will soon come to other states. The state of Illinois is the most likely candidate that may have to seek protection from creditors, with Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Kentucky rounding out the worst five states in terms of financial strength. I have spent an entire career helping organizations avoid bankruptcy. As a certified public accountant, I have noticed a set of events that organizations go through leading up to insolvency and eventually bankruptcy. The longer a state waits to address its fundamental financial problems, the less likely financial survival will be. In the case of Puerto Rico, the events leading up to its bankruptcy on May 3, 2017, were occurring a decade or more before, with little to no wherewithal to solve the problem. What is different with the state bankruptcy is that the federal approval and legislation is required to allow it to occur. Thus far, only Puerto Rico has been able to file for protection. States are not able to file bankruptcy without federal approval and corresponding legislation to allow it. The Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, PROMESA, provided for the establishment of an oversight board appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, with oversight by the courts. An interesting op-ed by a citizen from Puerto Rico entitled "The Hardships of Living Under Reorganization Are Painfully Apparent." The first, elected officials of Puerto Rico are no longer effectively in control of their own destiny, nor are their citizens. This is what is in store for other states not heeding the warning. What happened to the governor of Puerto Rico recently is an example of what happens when people get angry and they see their rights and responsibilities impeded because of financial woes. While Promesa covers Puerto Rico and other territories of the United States, Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code of the United States covers municipalities, school districts, and cities. States, because they have sovereign immunity, cannot file bankruptcy. States, however, can become insolvent, as has happened in Puerto Rico. What that means is that you no longer have enough money to pay your bills. Upon insolvency, the federal government can step in as the lender of last resort and appoint an administrator over the state's finances. Since a state has never filed for bankruptcy, the case law does not exist, and the PROMESA oversight protection provides a clue as to how such an insolvency would be dealt with. So what does insolvency look like? First, insolvency is a condition in which your financial options are extremely limited. For instance, creditors are less likely to continue lending money. Interest rates start to increase at a rapidly increasing rate, reflecting bankruptcy costs and the ability to pay. This type of thing happened in Chicago, which is obviously a city and not a state, but they saw their cost of borrowing increase significantly. And then finally, there are stacks of unpaid bills, which force states' creditors to cut off essential services. What happens is that the availability of financial capacity, or the ability to borrow, of the state declines. Specifically, the availability and access to cash to fund operations becomes impaired. That typically starts at the beginning of another recession. Once cash becomes impaired, governments will typically be faced with layoffs and cuts first to non-essential services and then to essential services. Attempts to increase taxes to increase funds available will only work on those with no other options. In other words, a company or organization that has the ability to move will do so. Those unable to move will become less competitive if they are not able to pass the cost on to the consumer. Concurrently, the state will find fewer companies will locate to the state until the financial outlook is more certain. The longer this uncertainty exists, the greater the likelihood of a downward spiral to bankruptcy or insolvency. This is where decisive action must be taken or the financial rescue becomes impossible. For the state to declare bankruptcy, a bill similar to PROMESA will have to be passed in order for financial reorganization to begin. Unfortunately, most states in trouble financially are usually under the misguided opinion that they can tax their way out of the problem. Since we live in a world where people and companies are free to move, this assumption is fatal and usually causes the state to wait until it's too late. Due to the free movement of people and organizations, states operate in as much of a competitive environment as do corporations. Only the most vulnerable have no options. In a financial spiral, populations of workers and taxpayers start to move further, negatively impacting tax revenue and putting the state in a death spiral. The longer it takes the state to realize the crisis, the more severe the results will be. Creditors in bankruptcy, particularly bondholders, will be paid very little of the amount owed. Every public sector worker, however, will be negatively impacted. These workers will see their pay cut, benefits going forward slashed, and layoffs to bring spending under control. Property owners, however, will be negatively affected since the state, through an oversight board, could increase the property taxes substantially high enough to render the property worthless. If such an irresponsible action were to be taken, however, the probability of future survival of the state would be severely impaired. In the decades of doing financial restructuring, the worst thing a debtor can do is to delay facing the crisis head on. The longer the crisis responses are delayed, the more severe the austerity measures in the least likely for survival. It is time for all of us to take this crisis seriously. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WQFX-FM in Biloxi, Mississippi. Welcome to our new listeners in the Magnolia State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.